The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article by Lee Haber is titled, A Fellow African Saved Elizabeth Nyamayaro's Life, So She Became a Humanitarian to Pay It Forward. As an 8-year-old living in a village in Zimbabwe, Elizabeth Nyamayaro was on the brink of starvation. And then she was rescued by a United Nations worker who fed her, gave her water, and inspired her to devote her life to humanitarianism. Nyamayaro's profound and soul-nourishing memoir, I Am a Girl from Africa, is now in bookstores. Fulfilling a lifelong dream of working for the institution that saved her life nearly 4 decades ago, Nyamayaro went from nearly dying during a 2-year drought that struck her village to graduating from the London School of Economics and serving in senior leadership roles at the UN, where she launched He for She, a global initiative addressing gender inequality. Her book tells the incredible story of that unlikely journey. And yet, when I spoke with Nyamayaro, her success seemed faded. Now in her mid-40s, Nyamayaro's passion, eloquence, and joy light up the room. She's a woman who's changing the world. The opening scene of your memoir is breathtaking. You've been left entirely on your own for days so your grandmother can visit a sick woman in another village. You've used up your food and water. Tell us what you were feeling. It's still so vivid. I had a beautiful childhood in the village where I was raised by my gogo, my grandmother. We all took care of one another and never wanted for anything. We grew our crops together, we shared what we had. But then a drought hit and wiped out the crops. We were always on the verge of starving. When the book opens, I've gone 3 days without food. I collapsed and fell to the ground. I remember thinking, this is it. But you lived to tell the tale. Yes, a miracle happened. A girl in a blue uniform, who I later found out worked for the United Nations, came through Gromanzi, which was the name of our village, and found me. She fed me a bowl of warm porridge and sips of water. She rescued me. Later I thought, well gosh, what if I was to be just like her, so that one day I can save the lives of others just as mine has been saved? That dream stayed with me. It took a lot of determination to achieve that dream. I can't say this without getting emotional. I am a product of my gogo. My grandmother was this fierce freedom fighter. She, like so many women in our community, fought to end the illegal British rule of our country. She taught me to never, ever give up. When I went to live in the city with my mother and father at age 10, who'd left me with gogo because they couldn't afford to support me, I kept her in my heart. And after moving with your parents and your siblings, you went to live with your Uncle Sam and Aunt Jane, an economist and an HIV/AIDS doctor, and were sent to one of the best private schools in Zimbabwe. Your tuition was financed by your parents selling vegetables and anything else they could, as well as by your aunt and uncle, who encouraged you to dream outside the box. Yes, and I worked with my aunt in the AIDS clinic and on weekends went to help out my parents. I had dreams of going to university and working for the UN, but after I graduated from secondary school at age 17, I got a job at a supermarket selling soybeans so I could in turn assist my parents in paying for the educations of their other children. At that point, my goal of becoming a humanitarian was on hold. When your Uncle Sam unexpectedly died, your dream revived. You knew that's what he would want. My plan was to move to London, get a job there, and save money to go to university, after which I would work for the UN. I didn't have friends, family, or contacts there. I didn't even have money for a plane ticket. But your gogo took care of that. She sold a few goats and cows to pay for your fare? She told me, what use are our possessions if not to serve the ones we love? I arrived in London with a small green suitcase and a couple hundred pounds in cash. And initially, everything that could have gone wrong did. I found a hostel to stay in, but I couldn't find a job anywhere and quickly ran out of money. Eventually, I made a deal with the hostel manager to be a janitor. I braided hair and did other odd jobs. Much later, a friend I'd made helped me get a sales rep job, and with some improvising, I was able to save enough money to finally enroll in university. What happened then reads like a fairy tale. You got your degree, you got admitted to the London School of Economics, and you finally did get your first job with the UN. I read about an opening to be a senior researcher with an African HIV/AIDS project funded by the UN, but they were looking for someone with a PhD, which I didn't have. However, I was persistent, and finally the person running the project, Dr. Julia Cleaves, agreed to hire me as an unpaid research assistant. They were so impressed by you that you were put in charge of more and more and began to travel all over Africa into communities that were being devastated by HIV and AIDS. I learned so much from my work with Aunt Jane, and I was committed to wanting to uplift to pay it forward. When there was an opening in a leadership role at the UN in Geneva, Dr. Cleaves, who'd become my mentor, sent me, and that's what paved the way for my job as a UN senior advisor on gender equality and for the launch of He for She. Tell us about He for She. In my role at the UN and growing up in Africa, I'd observed firsthand that men were often the problem when it came to keeping women down, whether in terms of rape and other forms of abuse, disparities in education and work, or in terms of controlling if a woman could protect herself against getting HIV from her husband. And contraception was and continues to be a huge issue. But if we were going to find ways of changing that dynamic, it made sense to me to invite men to be part of the solution. As Gloria Steinem has said, the human race is like a bird. It needs both wings to fly, and if one of those wings is clipped, then it can't soar. But it was a controversial idea to approach the issue that way. Some women were rightly embittered about what they'd suffered and didn't want to team up with those they saw as oppressors. But I also thought, why should all the responsibility be on women to make change? That approach proved effective. Tell us how. Men should innately know not to abuse women. They should know it's wrong to marry a child. They should know that equality in the workplace is a woman's right. So I created He for She as an inclusive movement in which men could work alongside women and girls in forging more equitable laws, in giving women better access to and decision-making about family planning, in giving girls access to education. Within 3 days after announcing the initiative, 100,000 men signed up to join. It generated 1.2 billion online conversations in the first week alone. Men began to examine their own privilege and figure out how they could leverage it to help improve things for women, especially in patriarchal cultures where women are doing most of the hard work while men are making all the important decisions. For example, in Malawi, some of the very same male chiefs who'd been marrying girls as young as 8 helped forge legislation banning child marriage and annulling many of the child marriages that had taken place, freeing the child brides and sending them back to school. What would you say is the biggest crisis we face today? Rising inequality. We're living in a world that is more divided than ever. When you think of the fact that the 26 richest people in the world own as much wealth as half of the world's population, it's devastating. When you think of the fact that in America, black people are still having to say, "Hey, Black Lives Matter," that keeps me up at night and helps me stay energized, especially when I think about how that concept is still being met with resistance. And we're witnessing hate against the Asian community. We can only solve these problems if everyone joins together to face them and make change. As a student of political science, do you ever intend to run for office? I come from a beautiful continent of 55 countries, 1.2 billion people, and we're nowhere near where we need to be in terms of female political leadership. A lot of our countries are still run by men. I see a huge opportunity for African women to lead. I am an African woman. I have to play my part. And so it is a responsibility that one day I hope I can realize. I owe it to young girls of color to show them what's possible, and that where we are born doesn't have to diminish or limit our dreams and potential. So yeah, that's something that hopefully one day I'm able, with God's blessings, to pursue. Our next article by Samantha Vincenti is titled, "Reporters Are Showing Us It's Okay to Be Vulnerable on TV." Sarah Sidner's ragged intake of breath was hard to watch. This is the 10th hospital that I've been. I'm sorry, the CNN correspondent told anchor Allison Camerota as she broke into tears. Sidner was reporting on a California family who'd been forced to hold a parking lot funeral for a loved one lost to COVID-19. It was 10 months into the coronavirus's grip on the United States. After a few seconds, Sidner began again. This is the 10th hospital that I have been in, and to see the way that these families have to live after this, and the heartache that goes so far and so wide, she continued, still crying, it's really hard to take. This moment, and similar ones that her broadcast colleagues experienced since March of 2020, are one thread of a much larger conversation around objectivity that's taken place in both TV and print newsrooms. The shared goal amongst journalists has always been maintaining accuracy while delivering the news as impartially as possible. But over the past 14 months, broadcast journalists have reported on multiple ongoing stories that have impacted us all to varying degrees, themselves included. A pandemic, a racial justice movement, a fiercely divisive political climate. For journalists, it's tested how well they can compartmentalize their feelings while covering heartbreaking stories. And for viewers, it presents a fuller picture of the news headlines. A reporter growing emotional mid-broadcast certainly isn't without precedent. In 1963, Walter Cronkite, considered by many journalists to be the epitome of a stoic newsreader, famously took off his glasses and struggled through his live announcement of JFK's assassination. It's happened to other broadcasters many times since. I don't blame anybody for showing emotion on the air. I don't think I would trust a reporter, male or female, who didn't show any emotion, Cronkite reflected in September 2001, when another national tragedy found anchors grieving on screen while they did their jobs. What is different now is the unique circumstance both reporters and viewers are living in. In March of 2020, Hoda Kotb burst into tears following a Today interview with Saints quarterback Drew Brees, pegged to New Orleans COVID spike. A week later, CNN's Erin Burnett's face crumpled as a guest described saying goodbye to her dying husband over FaceTime. Robin Roberts choked up as she eulogized an ABC cameraman who died from the virus. As quarantined Americans struggled to process it all at home, with the then president insisting there was actually nothing to worry about, these reporters' reactions validated the fact that what was unfolding was indeed horrific. When CBS This Morning first covered the video of George Floyd's death on May 26, 2020, Gayle King remembers being particularly shaken by the sunglasses-on-head nonchalance that Derek Chauvin displayed as he kept his knee on Floyd's neck. What got me was that he was an unidentified black man, she tells Oprah Daily. What kind of label is that when you're dying that way? Just moments later, CTM moved on to a viral clip of New Yorker Amy Cooper calling the police against black birdwatcher Christopher Cooper in Central Park. It's never felt fine, but that particular day it was like a 1-2 punch of ugliness directed at black men, King says. My son is 33, so that's always my first go-to in the back of my mind. Today's Chanel Jones says that the week Floyd was killed, she also struggled to process the events, both as a journalist on live TV and a black parent of three children. I wouldn't be me if I looked straight at the camera and tried to act as if I understood what was happening, she tells Oprah Daily. My kids were confused and I just finished having conversations with them about the same topic. Jones says she'd never been that vulnerable on TV before, especially with something like this where it involves your family and frankly your identity. To newsroom editors and producers, a journalist's personal identity can be seen as a hindrance, particularly when they're not straight, white, or male. For example, some reporters of Asian American and Pacific Islander, or AAPI, descent recently shared that their non-Asian editors asked if they were too emotionally invested to stay unbiased while covering the Georgia spa shootings that killed 8 people, including 6 Korean women. Meanwhile, Regina Kim pointed out in Rolling Stone that members of Korean language media were able to cover facets of the story more accurately, including statements from non-English speakers and the correct way to spell victims' names. Broadcaster Soledad O'Brien, who currently hosts Disrupt and Dismantle on BET, tells Oprah Daily this is a familiar dynamic for black journalists, too. There's this idea that a black reporter can't be objective if the topic is about black things, yet a white reporter certainly can be about everything, she says. I think that's forced a conversation about what exactly objective means and what do we want from reporters. Objectivity in journalism took root in the 1920s amid a shifting newspaper market that faced mergers and closures, when nonpartisan reporting also seemed like the best way to serve the widest audience through fewer papers. Prior to this, the number of papers allowed for different publications to each take their own stance. But according to Gina Bellaria, a professor of journalism, media writing, and digital media at Sonoma State University, since the 20s, the concept of objectivity has mutated into a common belief that the journalist needs to be a paragon of objectivity, which is impossible, she argues, because everybody's brain is influenced by implicit bias. Of course, today's media landscape is much different than the one of 1920. About a quarter of U.S. adults get their news from YouTube, per the Pew Research Center, and 7 in 10 of the most popular independent news channels are oriented around a personality. Those often independently run channels, such as accounts with over a million followers like Brian Taylor Cohen's or Mark Dice's, which have no ties to an external media organization, aren't beholden to the same expectations of accuracy or editorializing. Meanwhile, reporters from traditional outlets remain held to another model that, for example, shies away from outright use of the word lie when members of government publicly present untruths as facts. It's a critical time to reconsider the best ways to tell important stories with all of their nuances, though that isn't to say that the solution is a wholesale shift toward what critics have long deemed advocacy journalism, which purposely promotes a specific point of view. But what we've been doing clearly hasn't been working, Bellaria says, referring to the current record-low trust in information worldwide. Bellaria adds that as a society, we're so fractured we don't even agree on the same reality right now. Brooke Baldwin, who departed CNN after 13 years in April 2021, says that while covering a tragedy live in the field back in 2008, a male colleague warned her, "Do not cry." She didn't, for the record. After years of getting to know herself as a broadcaster, Baldwin's own stiff upper lip stance evolved. As you get older, maybe you feel more free to show up as your authentic self, she posits. And my authentic self is a human being with emotions. And in her experience, reactions to her vulnerability were supportive on social media. They're like, "Brooke, I'm crying right along with you. Do not apologize." No viewer wants a world in which broadcast journalists burst into tears on a constant basis. Everyone that I spoke to for this article agreed that when breaking any story, facts and data must lead. Most of the time, you need to tell it straight, and that means no tears, says Baldwin. If modeling empathy can inspire more empathy, Jones hopes that seeing TV broadcasters show vulnerability on air can help to light a path for viewers who are still processing what has been a particularly grueling few years in our country. It's not about being right. It's not about somebody saying, "Oh my gosh, did you hear her argument? I need to agree with her." It's about having empathy, Jones says. I think at times, if you can be vulnerable, that's teaching empathy, in a way, to adults. We teach our kids to have empathy, but as adults, it's important that we remember to talk to our neighbors with that sense of empathy, too. That's the only way we can heal. Our next article by Samantha Vincenti is titled, "What is Monica Lewinsky doing now?" He was my boss. He was the most powerful man on the planet. He was 27 years my senior, with enough life experience to know better. He was, at the time, at the pinnacle of his career while I was in my first job out of college, Monica Lewinsky wrote in a 2018 Vanity Fair essay. In the late 1990s, Lewinsky was at the dawn of her adult life, barely old enough to drink in a bar. Yet her name was a go-to punchline in tasteless late-night monologues. Her character ridiculed in mainstream media and by private citizens, all because she'd been one half of the most famous extramarital affair in U.S. political history. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton recalls, "When news of Lewinsky's affair with President Clinton initially broke, he vehemently denied it privately and publicly. I did not have sexual relations with that woman, he infamously claimed in a January 1998 news conference. Ahead of the first news reports, President Clinton told his wife it was all a big mix-up. He said, "There's nothing to it. It's not true. I may have been too nice to her and may have paid her too much attention," Clinton said, adding that she found this explanation convincing at the time. Lewinsky signed an affidavit stating she and President Clinton never had a sexual relationship. She has claimed that he'd advised her to do so. And President Clinton denied it in a deposition for a separate legal suit that same January. It didn't take long for President Clinton's version of events to unravel, though, and by February of 1998, with help from the headline-making, secretly recorded confessions Lewinsky made to her former co-worker Linda Tripp, it became clear that his indiscretions with his intern were a fact. The gritty details of their encounters became widely known joke fodder, from the stained blue dress to the cigar. As Lewinsky said in a 2015 TED Talk, "Overnight, I went from being a completely private figure to a publicly humiliated one worldwide. I was patient zero of losing a reputation on a global scale almost instantaneously." Here's how she's handled the aftermath since. Lewinsky had a handbag line and hosted an odd dating show. President Clinton was ultimately acquitted of perjury and obstruction of justice in his 1999 impeachment trial, keeping both his presidency and his marriage to Hillary. Meanwhile, there was no roadmap for Lewinsky in terms of what a woman in her early 20s should do next when she's become an international laughingstock. A 1998 Herb Ritz photo shoot for Vanity Fair seemed to only cement her negative image as the other woman. Maureen Dowd deemed the shots pornography in the New York Times in September of 1998, calling out Lewinsky's bare shoulders and snug gingham shirt while claiming that it appears that there's one thing Monica has immunity from, brains. In the years since the scandal, Lewinsky's unusual life trajectory has led her down a few career paths. In 2000, her President Clinton-related legal debt had reached $1.5 million, she told the New York Times, and conventional employers weren't knocking down her door. She had a handbag line in 1999 and accepted a gig as spokeswoman for weight loss company Jenny Craig that same year. Lewinsky also made several TV appearances and hosted a 2003 Fox dating show called Mr. Personality. Like The Bachelorette or Love is Blind, except all of the male suitors wore creepy masks. She graduated from the London School of Economics in 2006. Moving from D.C. to New York City offered Lewinsky a modicum of anonymity, or at least a lighter version of the relentless attention she received everywhere. To a point. Even in New York, her reception is not always positive, Vanessa Grigoridis wrote in a 2001 New York profile. Not long ago, she was chased down the street by a group of men screaming epithets, and tabloids still report news like, "Monica eats potato chips," "Monica snuck out the kitchen door Baltazar," and "Monica stuffs herself with crab cakes." The New York Post nicknamed her the Portly Pepper Pot, a jab at her weight. In 2005, Lewinsky took a well-deserved decade-long break from the public's relentless gaze, moving to London. She began attending the London School of Economics. A Telegraph headline from 2005 stated, "Hello, boys. Freshers at LSE brace themselves for Monica." Earning a Master's of Science degree in social psychology. Her thesis sounds like it hit close to home. The title was In Search of the Impartial Juror, an exploration of the third-person effect in pre-trial publicity. Today, Lewinsky is a vocal anti-bullying advocate. "In 1998, I lost my reputation and my dignity. I lost my sense of self," Lewinsky said in her 2015 TED Talk titled The Price of Shame. "When this happened to me 17 years ago, there was no name for it. Now we call it cyberbullying." Her remarks served as a plea to resist the urge to pile on, saying that public humiliation as a blood sport has to stop. For the past 5 years, Lewinsky has been delivering speeches on the harmful effects of bullying. She's also been a contributor to Bystander Revolution, an anti-bullying resource founded by Mackenzie Bezos, author and ex-wife of Amazon's Jeff Bezos. In 2019, Lewinsky was interviewed on Last Week Tonight with John Oliver for their public shaming episode. When millions of people feel the need to weigh in and do it potentially for years, the punishment can be vastly disproportionate to the offense, Oliver said. And perhaps the best example of this is Monica Lewinsky. In the segment, Oliver pointed out a parade of jokes from Jay Leno that were particularly disgusting, including a fake Dr. Seuss book titled The Slut in the Hat. Since the 1990s, there's been a somewhat more enlightened public shift in viewing how cruelly Lewinsky was treated during and after President Clinton's impeachment trial. Author Erica Jong is among those who've since regretted how they spoke of Lewinsky back then. "It's a terrible thing to have to survive, and I have far more empathy now," Jong told the Daily Beast in 2015. In a documentary about the situation, President Clinton kind of indirectly apologizes to Lewinsky as well. "I feel terrible that her life has been defined by it, unfairly, I think," he said. "Over the years, I watched her trying to get a normal life back again, but you got to decide how to define normal." She's a producer of Impeachment, American Crime Story. The third season of Ryan Murphy's American Crime Story was based on the book A Vast Conspiracy, the real sex scandal that nearly brought down a president. Booksmart star Beanie Feldstein will play Monica Lewinsky, while Clive Owen will portray President Clinton. Murphy knew that the woman at the center of the true story should be involved in the project. "I told her nobody should tell your story but you, and it's kind of gross if they do," Murphy told The Hollywood Reporter. "If you want to produce it with me, I would love that, but you should be the producer and you should make all the money." Lewinsky keeps a good sense of humor about her notoriety these days. Monica Lewinsky's Twitter account, created when she returned to public appearances in 2014, describes her as an anti-bullying activist, TED Talks giver, Vanity Fair contributor, rap song muse, ex-beret model, emotional daredevil, and knitter. A Democrat, Lewinsky often tweets about politics and serves up the occasional hilarious comeback. In response to a 2018 tweet from Florida Senator Marco Rubio that began, "Although written by interns at Politico," Lewinsky chided, "Blaming the intern is so 1990s. Our next article by Elena Nicolou is titled, "Is Selling Sunset Real? This California luxury real estate agent doubts it." Chrissy Teigen isn't convinced that the women of Selling Sunset, a Netflix series that follows a group of luxury real estate agents in LA, are actually real estate agents. In one tweet, she shared, "I look at LA real estate a lot and have never seen any of these people." The Cravings cookbook author is far from the only one to doubt the reality of this Netflix reality TV show. Since the most recent season of Netflix's possibly unscripted show premiered, theories and blind items about the validity of the LA set show have abounded. Much like Teigen, working agents who watch Selling Sunset tell OprahMag.com that they're struck by the same thought: is this real? "I've never heard of them," Susie Daly, a luxury real estate agent at One Lux in Orange County, California, says by way of an answer. With Netflix venturing into the luxury real estate scene once again with the Hampton set show Million Dollar Beach House, the question is more pressing than ever. So we set forth to find out. Behold OprahMag.com's investigation into the authenticity of Selling Sunset. Yep, Selling Sunset follows licensed real estate agents. Spoiler alert, the Oppenheim Group itself definitely exists. In fact, there's an entire office ecosystem not depicted in the show. According to the brokerage's website, there are 5 agents not seen on the show. Call us Alice Kwan and Nicole Young. We want the tea. Further, Selling Sunset's stable of well-dressed agents are definitely accredited to do more than stir up office drama, even if Teigen hadn't previously heard of them. Per licensee, all 10 of the Oppenheim Group's agents are licensed, though Amanda Smith is not listed. Jason and Brett Oppenheim, who own the brokerage, are the 5th generation in the family to practice LA real estate, according to Brett's website. Jason is even thinking of expanding the Oppenheim Group to another city. Clearly confident in their careers, the cast of Selling Sunset responded to Teigen's comment gamely. We all are very active real estate agents, and we are very, very busy at the moment, Heather Ray Young told Access Hollywood. Maya Vander told us that she can find Tegan a house in Miami. Chriselle retweeted Tegan, offering her a $2 million listing in Studio City. Tegan stated dismay at having bought last week, and Jason Oppenheim complimented her on the purchase. In strongly worded statement to People, Jason defended his brokerage's agents and shut down all rumors. Mary, Heather, Maya, and Christine were licensed and successful real estate agents at the Oppenheim Group many years prior to filming our show. Amanza worked with us as a designer and had been a close friend of Mary's and mine for many years. Chriselle was a practicing agent at another brokerage many years previous to filming Selling Sunset. As a licensed agent, Davina has transacted many deals before joining the team in 2018, Oppenheim said, adding that any insinuation that the agents on our show are not experienced, successful, or licensed evidences a complete disregard for the facts. But that hasn't stopped folks from assuming otherwise. Assuming they are working agents, Daily suspects Selling Sunset has benefited their careers. Because of the show, they've gotten notoriety in business, she says. The show has been successful in that respect. But the show is definitely staged and scripted to a certain degree. That said, Selling Sunset truthers, aka people who harbor beliefs that the show is entirely scripted and the cast are actors, could gather enough details to fuel their argument. For proof, look no further than the show's creator, Adam DeVello, the mastermind behind The Hills, a popular MTV series that followed wealthy young women in LA between 2006 to 2010. Speaking to Refinery29 about The Hills, DeVello said he was shackled to reality of the character's situations, but also open to reshooting scenes and manufacturing moments. Clearly, DeVello has a knack for turning real people into characters and for making the state of California look glittering, appealing, and totally inaccessible. With reality TV pedigree like that, it's obvious that the reality in Selling Sunset's reality TV is meant to be taken with a grain of salt. The show is about real estate agents, but it may not be real. Understand? Take a look at the show's structure. Selling Sunset presents a version of real estate in which the source of drama is low-grade feuds between coworkers, not the grind of contract negotiations or inspections. The agent's days are punctuated by the click of high heels and the sting of savage comments. In fact, the workplace dynamic ricocheting between the Oppenheim Group's low-lying tables is so toxic it's been parsed by an advice columnist. Essentially, even if Selling Sunset is about nothing, it also somehow has plot, one of the quintessential hallmarks of a docu-soap. And who better to carry out that plot than actors? Selling Sunset's cast could be comprised of actors who happen to have real estate licenses and act out scenarios for the show. The IMDb pages are proof. Chriselle starred in soaps for years. Christine appeared in films. Honestly, I'd think you were lying to me if you told me that they weren't actors, Sophia Weeks, a real estate agent based out of New Hampshire, tells OprahMag.com. Do I think that they're licensed? Yeah. Do I think that if they weren't on that show, they would have the success that they do? No. However, the cast denies that the show is completely scripted. Chriselle said it's more like a gentle shoosh toward drama. They can sometimes nudge us to address things, but what we say is all us. Beware anyone that says otherwise. Gotta own it, Chriselle wrote on her Instagram stories. Christine also said that certain storylines were amped up, including how she met her husband, Christian Richard. I actually met him through a girlfriend of mine, but Mary spun the story that he was a client. We were dating for 3 months, and then we bought a house together, but television is fun, she said on Holly and Phil This Morning. Finally, like other staged reality TV shows, Selling Sunset's narrative arc is stitched together through a mix of editing and nudged conversations. One Redditor's immensely researched season 3 timeline points out the gaps and inconsistencies in filming. For example, news broke of Chriselle's divorce during the Botox and Burgers event, not when it's mentioned in the show. According to a piece on Anonymous Intel, entire showings have been speculated to be scripted, like the season 1 interaction between Maya and a flirtatious millionaire. Rumor has it he may have been Vander's friend from high school, pretending to be romantically interested for plot. Hilariously, one TikTok user pointed out a stage showing of her own house in season 3 of Selling Sunset. In the show, Christine says her client is a male plastic surgeon. "I'm trying to get a hold of my client, but he's in Europe," she says. The TikTok user writes, "I wasn't in Europe. I never met Christine." In the comments, she explains that she is selling her house, but did not want to be on the show. Selling Sunset created a fake owner for plot's sake. Real estate agents say Selling Sunset couldn't be further from the truth. Most importantly, though, Selling Sunset depicts a version of real estate that's different than the lived experience for most agents. Far and away, Selling Sunset's emphasis is on interpersonal relationships, not the typical source of drama for agents, selling houses. There's no inter-office drama like that whatsoever. Nobody has time to be talking about a boyfriend or a spouse. You're too busy concentrating on your clients and having to deal with their issues, Daly says. Popular real estate shows like Selling Sunset and House Hunters also simplify agents' role in the home buying process. These TV shows don't give us enough credit for how much goes into each and every transaction, the behind the scenes, the negotiation, Weeks says. Selling Sunset fast forwards past the ongoing compromises and conversations between buyers, sellers, inspectors, and creditors. One big misconception is that it's easy. It's not easy at all. It's very difficult, Daly says, of the arduous journey to the closing table. Daly's job is made complicated by her high net worth client's strong personalities, as she puts it. You're like a doctor. You can't choose the ethics of your patient. If they're not a kind person, if they're not a good person, you maybe don't find that out until you're a ways in. Then you're having to deal with this person. That's difficult, she says. It's this reason, the focus on the agent's personalities, not on the real estate process, that Jason expressed regret at joining Selling Sunset. "Had I known the show would be this focused on our personal lives, I probably wouldn't have signed up for it," he told Hello Magazine. "I wanted it to be all about the nuances of real estate, but I now realize the show I envisioned wouldn't be that popular. I've come to accept the idea that I'm on more of a reality show than a real estate show." Weeks, who sells homes to middle-class families, thinks that her less glitzy but still high-stakes day-to-day life could make for a good TV show, one that could actually benefit prospective homeowners. "If you have any power to get a show with normal realtors following normal agents, I'd love that. I'd love for people in America to see what we really do and why it's important to have a good agent on your side. There are fires we put out that they don't even know about, and if they did, they probably wouldn't sleep that night," Weeks says. So does it matter if Selling Sunset is real anyway? Like most reality TV shows, it appears that Selling Sunset is a blend of manufactured moments and real drama. Chrishell's raw reaction to her sudden divorce from Justin Hartley, for example, was too real to deny. Ultimately, adherence to reality has never been the appeal of Selling Sunset. Escape from reality is. Along with other shows set in the luxury real estate sphere, like Million Dollar Listing, Selling Sunset is a portal to another world. They may not be selling houses, but the agents of Selling Sunset are definitely selling audiences a fantasy that one day we might also walk through a $75 million home too. Our next article by Grant Reiner is titled, "Billy Porter Said Pose Helped Him Work Through the Shame of Being HIV Positive." From daring fashion choices that subvert gender norms to powerful performances in programs like Pose, Billy Porter, 51, has already established himself as a highly visible, progressive figure in the entertainment industry. He's chosen to open up even further, revealing in a May Hollywood Reporter story that he was diagnosed with HIV in June 2007, something he had previously kept private. In the piece, Porter spoke candidly about his unexpected diagnosis at New York's Callan Lord Community Health Center and the initial feelings of fear and embarrassment that came with it. He also talked about how an extended stay in Long Island with his husband, Adam Smith, during the COVID-19 pandemic helped Porter better reflect on the traumas he's faced in his life. Porter's star began to grow when he originated the role of Lola in the hit musical Kinky Boots, which earned him a Tony and a Grammy in 2013. Years later, he made Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People of 2020 list. Having lived through the plague, my question was always, why was I spared? Why am I living? Porter wrote in an Instagram caption accompanying one of the photos in the Hollywood Reporter story, likely alluding to the HIV/AIDS epidemic of the 1980s. I was the generation that was supposed to know better, and it happened anyway. Well, I'm living so that I can tell the story. Porter said that at the time of his diagnosis, he was on the precipice of obscurity, already struggling with type 2 diabetes and bankruptcy. Prior to 2007, Porter had small roles in films like Noel and The Intern, and explained that he kept his HIV-positive diagnosis close to the chest for fear it would hurt his professional prospects. I was trying to have a life and a career, and I wasn't certain I could if the wrong people knew. It would just be another way for people to discriminate against me in an already discriminatory profession, he shared. According to Porter, Pose was pivotal for helping him understand his feelings on having HIV. His character, Pray Tell, is also HIV positive. Pose was an opportunity to work through the shame of HIV and where I have gotten to in this moment, he said. And the brilliance of Pray Tell in this opportunity was that I was able to say everything that I wanted to say through a surrogate. In 2019, Porter won the Primetime Emmy for Outstanding Lead Actor in a Drama Series, becoming the first gay black man to do so. Porter, who grew up in the Pittsburgh area, spoke in the piece about not wanting to share his HIV-positive status because he feared his mother would be ostracized from the Pentecostal church. My mother had been through so much already, so much persecution by her religious community because of my queerness, that I just didn't want her to have to live through their I told you so's, he said. In other interviews, Porter has spoken about the difficulty of his upbringing. In January 2021, he told The Guardian that his childhood church said that I would never be blessed as long as I choose to be gay, and also spoke about finding forgiveness for the stepfather who sexually abused him. In the Hollywood Reporter piece, Porter talked about finally sharing the news with his mother. She was empathetic and understanding, and Porter said after that conversation, it had felt like a hand was holding my heart clenched for years, and it was all gone. Porter also shared information on what his life looks like now and how well he's doing health-wise. Per HIV.gov, the virus often impacts queer men of color, and though the infection rates are falling thanks in large part to medical advances, there's still a stigma surrounding HIV, Porter said. Yes, I am the statistic, but I've transcended it. This is what HIV positive looks like now. I'm going to die from something else before I die from that. My T-cell levels are twice yours because of this medication, Porter said. I'm the healthiest I've been in my entire life, so it's time to let all that go and tell a different story. There's no more stigma. Let's be done with that. Our next article by Samantha Vincenti is titled, Peg Entswistle was a real-life figure. Here's what led up to her jumping off the Hollywood sign. Hollywood, a Netflix miniseries portraying an alternate history of 1940s Tinseltown, features a central movie within a movie that's based on the life of an actress named Peg Entswistle, sort of. In the show, screenwriter Archie Coleman sells a script to Ace Studios. But then director Raymond Ainslie proposes changing it to be a film about a black actress from Mississippi named Meg, not Peg, which would allow him to cast his girlfriend Camille in the starring role. That's showbiz. While creators Ryan Murphy and Ian Brennan took ample creative liberties with their characterization of that era, Ace Studios is fictional, for example, the actress that inspired Coleman's script was a real person who met a very sad end. Here's the true story of what happened to Peg Entswistle, who infamously killed herself by jumping off the Hollywoodland sign, according to James Zarret Jr.'s biography, Peg Entswistle and the Hollywood Sign Suicide, and journalist Karina Longworth's You Must Remember This podcast. Millicent Lillian Entswistle was raised in New York City. Entwistle's British parents divorced when she was 2 years old. Entwistle and her father Robert, who was an actor himself, immigrated to New York in 1913. After a minor stint on Broadway, Robert retired from acting and opened a store in Manhattan. But young Millicent had developed her own dreams of acting on stage. And after seeing the play Peg Oh My Heart as a preteen in 1921, she renamed herself Peg. However, Peg Entwistle's life and Broadway goals were uprooted a year later, when her father was killed following a hit-and-run in New York City. After a brief stint in Ohio, Entwistle and her two half-brothers moved to L.A. under the care of their uncle and aunt in 1923. Their new home was located in what would become L.A.'s Hollywood Hills neighborhood. She had a promising short-lived stage career. After training in L.A., according to Longworth, Entwistle returned to the East Coast around 1925 to pursue a stage career in Boston and New York City. Betty Davis said she was inspired to act as a teenager after seeing Entwistle on stage in a Boston production of Henrik Ibsen's The Wild Duck. Entwistle became the young Bette's idol, not just her inspiration to become an actress, but a specific model that the teenage future star saw herself in, Longworth explained. Eventually finding parts on Broadway, Entwistle married a man named Robert Keith, an actor with a history of debts, arrest, and alleged abuse. After divorcing Keith in 1929, citing mental anguish in the court papers, Entwistle realized the New York theater community was effectively shutting her out due to the unsavory association with her ex-husband. Entwistle's one movie, 13 Women, premiered around the time of her death. Moving back to L.A. after her divorce, Entwistle continued to act on stage, and Studio RKO cast her in a supernatural film titled 13 Women. However, Entwistle's part as Hazel Clay Cousins was shredded in the editing room, cut down to just 15 seconds. The problem wasn't Entwistle's performance, but a perceived violation of a motion picture production code known as the Hays Code. They required heavy edits to 13 Women after an early screening. Conceived by former Postmaster General Will Hays, NPR explains that the Hays Code aimed to keep Hollywood content wholesome. On September 16, 1932, after failing to secure an RKO studio contract and a string of other professional disappointments, as biographer Zurich recounted, Entwistle told her uncle she was going to the drugstore. She instead made a short trip up to the nearby Hollywoodland sign, climbed up the 45-foot ladder behind the H, and jumped. She was 24 years old. The anonymous hiker who reported Entwistle's body also found her shoe, jacket, and her purse, which contained a suicide note. "I am afraid I am a coward. I am sorry for everything," Entwistle had written. "If I had done this a long time ago, it would have saved a lot of pain. P.E." Zurich disputes the lore that the critically panned 13 Women opened on the same night Entwistle killed herself, though it was sometime in that same period. In yet another example of Entwistle's rotten luck, he also writes that her uncle received a letter from RKO Studios shortly after her death offering her another film role. Her ashes were interred with her father's at the Oak Hill Cemetery in Springdale, Ohio. Though, per the BBC, it wasn't until 2010 that her grave was marked. Ryan Murphy says he related to Entwistle's story. Ryan Murphy, who co-created Hollywood, remembers reading about Entwistle growing up. He's among those who view the manner of Entwistle's suicide and the perceived reason she did it as a symbol of how Hollywood can crush a would-be star's spirit. "She was always the cautionary tale," Murphy tells OprahMag.com. "When I moved out to L.A. in the late 80s, one of the first places I went was up to the top of the Hollywood sign. There were tours where they would show you which letters she jumped off and how she did it." Murphy says Entwistle's failure really meant something to him when he was first trying to make it himself. "I was very interested in her at a time where I was also trying," he continues. "The idea that Hollywood can chew you up and spit you out and not really be fair, I've never really ventured far from that idea, so I really just related to her struggle and her sadness." The Hollywood sign originally read Hollywood Land. The Hollywood Land sign was erected in 1923, the same year that Peg Entwistle moved to L.A. with her relatives. It was both a figurative advertisement for the city's glitzy industry in the early years of Hollywood's golden age, and a literal advertisement for a new real estate development, according to HollywoodSign.org. Harry Chandler, then publisher of the LA Times, paid $21,000 for the lit-up letters to promote the housing venture he had invested in. The showy billboard illuminated in four timed segments: Holly, Wood, Land, and then the entire Hollywood Land word. Originally meant to stand for just a year and a half, the sign fell into disrepair during the Great Depression. The storied H had fallen off by the late 1940s, making it read Hollywood Land. The Hollywood Chamber of Commerce took over maintenance in 1949, making the Hollywood part shiny and new, and dropping the land. Guess eight letters are easier to care for than 13. Some believe the Hollywood sign is haunted by Entwistle. As Vanity Fair has reported, joggers and rangers in LA's Griffith Park have reported seeing the ghost of the Hollywood sign. Sightings of a mysterious blonde woman, typically accompanied by a strong smell of gardenias, began in the 1940s, and they're still reported today. As legend has it, wander near the sign on a foggy night, and you just might encounter her yourself. Our next article by Lane Dalfin is titled, What Does It Mean to Dream About a Hidden Room in Your House? Dear Dreamcatcher, I have the same dream at least once a week, which shows me a secret passage in my home that leads to a bedroom with a huge bathroom. Inside the bathroom's tub, there is a large amount of money. When I reach to grab it, I become aware that it's only a dream, but I desperately try to bring the money into reality with me. I wake up looking for this passage, convinced that it's real and that I just can't find it behind my walls. Signed, Explorer. Dear Explorer, to start, there's a distinct difference between a dream that's recurred for a few months and one that's repeated itself for years. A recently recurring dream is likely a message from your unconscious calling your attention to a current situation. But if you've been having this dream for years, it's more like a favorite expression, a familiar thought pattern you use whenever you feel a certain way. In this case, my analysis is the same regardless. If the dream only began recently, perhaps this analysis will help you identify the specific waking life event that triggered it. Every part of a dream represents a different aspect of your psyche. Typically, your own role in a dream is the aspect of yourself you feel most connected to. The less familiar parts of your psyche take the form of other people, places, animals, or even things. Our minds are full of potential. We can be happy, sad, heroic, selfish, giving, funny, serious, and so much more. But in childhood, we're conditioned to believe that some personality traits are more valuable than others, so we end up emphasizing those qualities while relegating others into the background. The psychoanalyst Carl Jung called the underdeveloped aspect your shadow. From this Jungian perspective, the house in this dream represents your psyche as a whole. In other words, the house is you. The secret passage is a route to find a less familiar aspect of yourself, your shadow. Which brings us back to the question, why does your personal path to self-discovery take you to a large bathroom with a tub full of cash? The symbols that your dream presents are typically fraught with emotion. For example, many of us think of a bathroom as a place to get clean, while others would say a bathroom is a messy, smelly place. What comes to mind when you think about a bathroom, and what's the significance of it being a particularly large one? If this were my dream, I might think of a bathroom as a place to let everything out. Do you perhaps need to find the space, literal or otherwise, where you feel safe to let your feelings out in a big way? Do you feel like you need to come clean about something? Alternately, it may be a case of you having created a messy situation in your life that effectively blocks you from success. If this resonates for you, could it be that your dream is encouraging you to tidy up your life? The bathtub with money in it is another image filled with possibilities. What comes to mind when you think about money? What does it represent for you? Personally, I think of money in a dream as representing my own value. On the other hand, I also have an association with money being the root of all evil. Might you be having a discussion with yourself about where the root of your own current issue lies? Is something disarrayed in your waking life, which is actually blocking your earning power? If the idea of self-worth resonates with you, it sounds like you're reaching for a deeper sense of self, but can't get a hold of it. as there are countless situations in which we all need to dip into our self-worth. If you're unable to find yours, this would explain why your brain is repeating both the image and the dream. Further, you say, I wake up looking for this passage, convinced it's real and that I just can't find it behind my walls. To which I respond, yes, it is real. You do have value deep within the walls of your self-house. What's more, you know that the value is in there somewhere, but you put up walls to hide it. The solution is to find a way to take down these walls, whether this recurring issue in your life has to do with your earning potential or a relationship is blocking the way to realizing your worth. How can this be accomplished? Start by giving yourself the space and permission to clean up any mess you may have created, or to take down the walls of self-judgment you've erected, so you can fully access your ability and potential. We'll end this week with some inspirational quotes from Oprah Daily. Aloneness is an opportunity, a state brimming with potentiality, with resources for renewed life. Florence Falk. The inward journey is about finding your own fullness, something that no one else can take away. Deepak Chopra. Loneliness is the human condition. Cultivate it. The way it tunnels into you allows your soul room to grow. Janet Fitch. Alone time is when I distance myself from the voices of the world so I can hear my own. Oprah. As long as you are breathing, it is never too late. Because people will tell you you're too old. People will tell you it'll never work. You have come too far to quit. Missy Elliott. We recognize that what unites us is greater than what divides us. John F. Kennedy. The more diverse a group of decision makers is, the more informed the decision will be. Kamala Harris. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.